Please be advised this podcast contains descriptions of graphic violence and it's not appropriate for children. I was working as a receptionist in a Melbourne brothel in 1999, and our boss was a beautiful lady called Vicky, who invited all of us to a staff dinner once a month. She'd often ask a guest speaker to come along to talk about various safety and self-care issues, particularly pertinent to sex workers, and one of those speakers was a young woman called Nikki Patterson, who was in the process of setting up a counselling practice in her own home. Nikki was a big hit at the dinner, which can't be said for every speaker. She was softly spoken and gentle, and she made the girls feel like they deserved to be listened to and that nothing they had to say would shock her. She was very good at her job. Everyone took one of her business cards, and a lot of the girls even followed through and called her about appointments. About a week later, the girls started complaining that she wasn't getting back to them. It never occurred to any of us that the murdered woman we'd heard about in the news was Nikki, let alone that she was the latest victim of a vicious predator who'd been attacking women in our community since he was 15 years old.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. Come with us as we go beyond the news cycle to find out how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
Peter Dupas is an Australian serial killer who currently resides in the Port Phillip Correctional Centre in the western suburbs of Melbourne. But we now know that he'd been raping, assaulting, and murdering women for 30 years by the time he was finally sent to jail for good. His last victim, Nikki Patterson, was actually the first murder for which he was convicted. We spoke recently to former homicide and arson detective Jeff Maher, who investigated Nikki's murder, and we started by asking him how Nicole Patterson and Peter Dupas crossed paths.
She started her psychotherapy and set her house up as a clinic. The front room is a clinic. And Dupas had obviously, over a period of time, stalked her. And he set himself up as her first client on that Monday.
So that was absolutely her first time she was taking the private business, or was it just the first client of the day?
No, it was the first client. My understanding, it was her first client. And it's a while ago now, so it's 1999.
No, I think you're right, 20 years ago. When I met her, she was talking to us about the fact that she had been working for some other organisation, but she was going out on her own. And so she was talking about what days I'm at the office, but I'm going to start working from home. So I think you're right. I think he was probably her first client ever at home.
So when you go to these scenes, you know, we haven't got hindsight. We don't know what's going on. So we have to hypothesise when we turn up the scene to say, well, what's going on? And it's only till the other building blocks of the case come together, like what the relatives can tell us, like what friends can tell us, the girl that was around there that night for dinner with her and discovered her body, and also door knocking and all the other blocks start to build the case up.
So what did you find at the scene?
We got called by the uniform van from Northcote, staffed by two female members, got called to the scene. They were called by Nikki's friend, who turned up there to go out for dinner with her, and she'd discovered Nikki's body in the front room. What happens is that the van goes in to see whether, in fact, it's occurred. It had occurred, and they then contact the local detectives. They get called out. The local detectives turn up, and they determine whether an offence has been committed, whether it might have been no suspicious circumstances, suicide or whatever, or whether an offence has been committed. So the detectives turn up, and they go out there, and they make an assessment, and they went straight in and made an assessment and contacted the on-call homicide crew, which
was a pretty violent scene that they found there, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. And they then contacted the on-call homicide scene, which was myself, senior sergeant, and I called out Dave Snare, who's just about to retire as well. So He was the sergeant on my crew, and then we assessed the job, and then we called the rest of the crew out.
What did you ascertain from the scene? I mean, I know that when you walk into a scene, you can gather a lot of information, like stabbings generally means that, the person knows their attacker. Is that true? And like little things like that that you can generally pick up from the scene?
We determine it's a little bit akin to fire investigation as well, whether there's been forced entry. Mm-hmm. You know, whether the fire is a forced entry or whether there's been forced entry into a building, say, it's the same with the homicide scene. It's the same set of rules. Had there been forced entry? No, there hadn't been forced entry. The person had been let in. It looked like the person was engaging with Nikki and some refreshments that morning. And, you know, then there was obviously a violent confrontation from the offender to Nikki, and as a result she tried to defend herself. Unfortunately, she was killed. It was until that night when her girlfriend turned up for dinner that, in fact, her body was discovered and the cavalry was called, you know, that we were called. So
what happens next in the investigation?
So we, you know, obviously cordon and contain the scene. We get as much as we can out of the witnesses that are there at the time, and that was her girlfriend. We then obviously try to identify who's been involved, meaning the deceased, and then contact, matter of priority, the relatives, which we did. We were able to contact them and start to get a bit more of a picture about what was going on.
Did she have a appointment book or anything? Was there anything helpful?
Yeah, there was a diary. And we got hold of the diary, which came later in the search of the scene. Mm-hmm. So when we get there, we don't know what's going on. Obviously, something had occurred earlier in the day, and it started to piece together when we spoke to the relatives, and they said, and they're very, very lovely people, that she said that she had her first client the following morning on her new vocation as a psychotherapist, and they saw her the night before. That connected with the door knocking, and never underestimate door knocking around particular a crime scene. We picked up a number of witnesses that heard a violent exchange between a female and a male earlier that morning, which was on Monday, the 9th of April, 1999. So heard that exchange and then heard some yelling and then heard nothing and just thought it was a domestic, a family dispute, and let it go. And that, it became relevant later on.
Okay.
So.
Oh, it's just terrible to hear that, but I wouldn't think it was anything else either. I mean, it's terrible to think that a stranger can walk into a woman's home under the pretense of whatever, being there to pick up something from Gumtree or have an appointment with her or whatever, and that they could have a screaming, violent argument and he could kill her and that no one could come looking. But I wouldn't go looking next door if I heard that.
Well,
I thought was an argument.
I hear what you say. The I suppose one of the issues is that Harper Street and all those streets that go off Westgarth Street all head down to the railway station. So there's a lot of toing and froing of people, and it could be a lot of, you know, you get, you know, rowdy, you know, people, you get drunken people.
Yeah.
And also, you know, it's an eclectic area.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's some low socioeconomic right up to, you know, some people with a lot of money living around there.
Yeah.
So they've got all sorts. So, yeah, I hear what you're saying. I do agree. But they thought it wasn't relevant, both of them. There were two in the street and they didn't contact.
Did Dupas live around the neighbourhood? How did he?
No, he was living over in Pascal Vale South.
Okay. So that's some ways from there, from Northcote.
Well, it is, but it was within the same realm of the Northcote and the Leader newspaper distribution. So
that's where he saw her ad.
Which she advertised in that paper.
So you mentioned that he'd obviously stalked Nikki, you know, pinpointed her as a victim. How did he go about that?
Well, we can only assume, because Dupas is really in his later years of offending, never really given any insight into his offending. So we can only assume, and my understanding is that there was an advertisement in the paper, not an advertisement, it was sort of an article in the paper that featured Nikki and a couple of other women talking about counselling services, psychotherapy mm-hmm. services, and had pictures of the three, yeah. including Nikki. And also in the same newspaper, I believe, that she had a advertisement mm-hmm. in there as well. So you can only assume, put, you know, one and one together makes three.
That people see something in and it's quite innocent and then they just pinpoint that or get fixated on it.
Yeah.
It's really scary.
And unfortunately it takes all kind in our community. So we can only assume that's how we sort of located or saw or started to get fixated on Nikki. And you've got to understand that Nikki's murder was the last of the murders.
Yep.
So last of the murders, first of the arrests.
Okay.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I was involved in the others' reviews. And
so were you involved in the other investigations at the time? What was his first murder? Was Margaret Marr?
Also, Margaret Marr, so it runs like this, is that we got called out. Our crew was so much under the pump at that point in time with jobs preparing briefs of evidence and we had a lot on. So I volunteered sight unseen to do the brief. Now, that's a bit unusual with the Homicide Squad because detective senior sergeants usually are investigation managers and we only do the briefs on police shootings. The shooting by police officers or members of the public and police officers being shot, which I've done quite a few investigations as well. But I volunteered for this and it turned out that, you know, 1999 to 2016, it followed me all the way, the particular investigation. I was the informant, as I said, which is rare. I charged him. We went to trial.
You charged Dupas?
I charged Dupas with Nikki Patterson's.
Yeah, right.
And then as a result of going to trial, it then worked backwards. So what we did was there was a detective by the name of Paul Scarlett, who's now a detective senior sergeant, an outstanding operator. Together with Mick Daly, who was at the Homicide Squad at the time, who's now an inspector, and also then you've got Mick Roberts, who was my boss until I retired last year at the Arson Explosive Squad. They were involved in Dupas. So we worked on that particular, on the Patterson job, and then they formed a task force to have a look back to see what other murders that Dupas had been involved in.
And why did you, seems like a silly question, but why did you think that he had been involved in other murders? So what made you believe that?
Because of the I suppose you'd call the signature of the style and the modus operandi of the murder mm-hmm. and how he conducted the murder and some of the unique signatures and in particular some of the injuries as well. So we then worked backwards and they formed a task force, Mikado, and I didn't go back to that. I stayed at the Homicide Squad in charge of a crew and I'd had Dupas convicted and he was doing life, no minimum, never to be released. So
for Nikki's murder.
For Nikki's murder. So a very small club mm-hmm. Because there are only a small number of people within the state doing life, no minimum, never to be released. So he was doing life, no minimum. He appealed. The appeal was knocked out and he was doing life, no minimum. Mick Daly and Paul Scarlett went across to Task Force Mikado, which was being run by, at the time, Greg Huff and by Chris O'Connor. And Chris O'Connor's now out of the job and Greg Huff's a detective superintendent of crime. Great operators as well. So they pursued Dupas for other crimes. And as a result of that, they started to form a brief against Dupas for the murder of Margaret Marr,
right.
who was found in Somerton, whose semi-naked body was found in Somerton, dumped amongst computer equipment on the side of the road.
In 1997.
So even though I was at the homicide squad at that point in time, it was not my job.
It came
under another detective senior sergeant, but was grabbed by Mercado to have a look at these other jobs.
Tell us about interviewing Peter Dupas when you brought him in.
For the murder of Nikki Patterson, we arrested him at the Excelsior Hotel in Queenstown. He was playing the pokies, and we grabbed him there.
What had led you to him being your suspect?
Well, it was a whole heap of things. There was a whole heap of evidence that was starting to build up. The diary we talked about, with a number and a name in it, which was Malcolm, was the name, and an appointment at 9 or 9:30 in the morning, and a mobile phone number. That phone number led us to a couple of innocent parties, who eventually were alibied. And then once we did, we got all the other bits and pieces of evidence together that we had, then we did some phone checks on Nikki's landline, you know, that old technology landlines.
Yeah.
So we did some phone checks on some landlines, and Dupas's name popped up amongst the subscribers. So there were a whole heap of subscribers ringing Nikki, but, you know, relatives and tradespeople and a whole heap of friends and that, but there was only one violent sexual predator that had done, at that time, I think about 20 to 25 years.
For rape?
For rapes, indecent assaults. He started when he was 16 by attacking the neighbour over the road, and it all went downhill from there. I think he did some kidnappings, a whole heap of stuff. So he'd done some bad time.
And his number pops up.
So his number pops up. We had all the other bits and pieces together. The planets all aligned, and we went and arrested him. And lo and behold, when we grabbed him at the Excelsior Hotel, he had what appeared to me to be a strike of a nail, meaning a human nail, down his cheek.
Mm-hmm.
And that only reinforced, you know, what we had. We went back from the Excelsior Hotel. He was initially interviewed in the car at the Excelsior Hotel by Paul Scarlett and by Steve Mitchell, who was a detective sergeant at Swan Hill, who was on my crew as well. And basically he gave some answers to some questions he was taken back to his house in Pasco Vale South, where we executed a search warrant on the house. And that's where we found a whole heap of other evidence there that related back to related back to the Dupas case, the Nikki Patterson case, which was a ripped up note on the same page as her advertisement in the leading newspaper, with his handwriting at the top, with her phone number, the time in the morning, her address, and also I think it had Malcolm written on it as well, the assumed name he'd given her. There was also the jacket found, which had her DNA on it and his DNA on it, and a number of other things that were found that sort of cemented case against him. As a result of that, I probably think within 40 hours of the crime, we charged him with the murder of Nikki.
That's pretty fast for homicide, is it? That's a pretty good result.
Pretty quick turnaround. Yeah. But
particularly, you know, given that he'd evaded charges on previous murders. It's a quick turnaround.
Yeah, we had a good and strong case against him, and we worked continuously for a substantial period of time, which would not happen now. Fatigue management came in not too long after really Dupas, by not allowing members to work substantial hours in one hit.
Okay.
A bit like doctors, you know, when they're working, junior doctors working like 20 hours.
Yeah.
And we're spot on. No, that's spot on. And I think that, you know, times have changed. So fatigue management came in. It wouldn't happen now, but we worked a substantial period of time until we basically charged him. And then we rocked on home and had some sleep and locked him up and went home.
What was he like?
Yeah, tell us about his
manner. Nondescript. You could walk past him in the street and not even think another thought about him. I described him as a bit of a Poindexter, as a bit of a geeky looking guy, as beige.
Yeah.
He wouldn't say much to us. He'd give his name, rank, and serial number, basically, but that was about it.
Dupas's beige exterior belies an incredibly dark and violent personality. Coming up, we'll hear more about the long list of crimes he'd committed before he was finally stopped by the murder of Nicole Patterson. At 15 years of age, still dressed in his high school uniform, Peter Dupas, bespectacled and unassuming, knocked on the next-door neighbour's front door. She was holding her 5-week-old baby when she answered, but she was well acquainted with Peter and not at all alarmed when he asked her if he could borrow a large, sharp knife. He said he needed to cut some potatoes for his mother, and the neighbour even commended him on being so helpful. Seconds later, he started slashing at her face with her own knife. She told police soon after, "I was holding onto the knife at one stage trying to break the blade. I was lying on my back and he was sitting on top of me. He said, 'It's too late. I can't stop now. They'll lock me up.'" After covering her mouth with his hand and repeatedly bashing the woman's head on the floor, Dupas stopped as abruptly as he had begun. He told police he didn't know why he'd attacked his neighbour and that he would never intentionally hurt anyone. "I can remember having the knife in my hand," Dupas told police. "I must have been trying to kill her or something." Well, we now know that Dupas went on to intentionally hurt dozens, if not hundreds, of women. And he was actually convicted for some of those crimes. Here's former homicide detective Jeff Maher.
There were a lot of other violent crimes that he committed, rapes that he got decent time for. So
It's alarming to think these very, very dangerous men, they're walking around.
So from getting life no minimum and me staying back at homicide and Scarlett and Daly and Greg Huff and Chris O'Connor moving on to Mercado, they build up a case against Dupas for Margaret Maher's murder, Summerton, 1997. And there was a glove found near a body. His DNA was located in that glove. Upon further review of new DNA technology, her injuries were very similar to other victims, we used the National Homicide Monitoring Program in Canberra to give evidence after he was charged because the signature was so unique. Dr. Jenny Moussos at the time was the head of that monitoring program. So he was charged by Scarlett, Paul Scarlett, with the murder of Margaret Maher and went to trial. Basically, he was, he made no comment. He was brought out of jail, interviewed, made no comment, put back in. And he was charged, went to trial, and he was convicted of the murder of Margaret Maher.
How had he come into contact with Margaret Maher?
Not exactly sure, but she used to hang around basically down towards the First and Last Hotel in that area around down the bottom of the Hume Highway, I think, the old Hume Highway. Not exactly sure. Mm. But, you know, it was the signature of the injuries were unique, and also the DNA in the glove right next to the body, and so on and so forth. you know, letters to him. And the jury, you know, quite quickly came to the decision that he was guilty. And, yeah, he was convicted, life no minimum, never to be released for the murder of Margaret Mark. So obviously people say to us, well, why do you do it? He's already doing life. Well, you do it for the victims.
In 1997, 2 years before Nicole Patterson's murder, 10-year-old Lisa Tinkler was tending to her grandfather's grave with her mother at Melbourne's huge Faulkner Cemetery. She told her mother she'd heard a woman scream in the distance, but her mother assured her that it was her imagination, or a trick of the wind that always seems to be howling around that part of town. It was actually a desperate cry for help from 25-year-old Mersina Helvargas, who'd been visiting her own grandmother's grave in the Greek Orthodox area of the cemetery. She'd been attacked from behind as she knelt and prayed. In his summing up of the murder trial that followed, Justice Cummins said to Dupas, "Just as Miss Helvargas's presence at the cemetery was typical of her goodness, your presence at the cemetery was typical of your evil. Cunning, predatory, and homicidal." Justice Cummins said that Mersina had had no chance against Dupas's strength, his knife, and his hatred. Mersina's father, George Helvargas, is still a strong presence in victims of crime support groups around Australia, and he was a well-known fixture at Dupas's earlier trials.
In the trials of Margaret Maher and Nikki, George Helvargas would be turning up at court all the time, and I got to know George, and as I say, Nikki Patterson family, fantastic people. The Helvargas family, awesome people.
George is a beautiful,
George is a beautiful man.
Great. So, but got to know George, and then he followed the trials, and he was at the trials, the first two trials. So, Paul Scarlett and I then joined forces as an investigation to review Mersina Helvargas.
So, are you saying that George suspected that Dupas had killed
Mersina? It was obviously suspected for a long time that Dupas was involved. So we started working on that particular job together, and as a result of that, we were able to gain further evidence. And one particular bit of evidence was that Paul, in his tenacious way, visited a number of crooks that had done time in jail. And I won't mention the other ones, but some nasty human beings. And eventually spoke to Fraser.
Andrew Fraser is a former high-profile Melbourne lawyer who was sentenced to 7 years imprisonment in 2001 for participating in the importation of a commercial quantity of cocaine. In 2006, Fraser was released 2 months early after agreeing to give evidence against Peter Dupas in his trial for the murder of Mersina Helvargas. Fraser claimed that Dupas had performed a disturbing mime for him, in which he detailed how he'd snuck up on Mersina and stabbed her from behind. The entire episode is detailed in Fraser's excellent book, Lunatic Soup, and again in the subsequent miniseries, Killing Time, which is also excellent.
And Fraser, as a result of that, gave us some evidence that we put in the form of a statement, and that statement went back to the OPP, Office of Public Prosecutions, and there'd never been enough evidence, close but no cigar.
Is this the mime?
And then he gave the evidence, he made a statement, and the miming of the killing of Mersina, and also that there were no forensics left at the scene.
Okay.
And it went from there. We then charged, Paul charged Dupas with the murder of Mersina, and I was involved in that trial with him. That trial went, Fraser was a witness, and he gave evidence in that trial under intense cross-examination. And as a result of that trial, the jury went out a number of days and come back and convicted Dupas of the murder of Mersina Helvargas.
Which is a classic example of why keep trying, isn't it?
Well, tenaciousness, yeah. And it was, because we knew that we're on a, you know, a couple of winners with a few of the others, and there's been, and there's a, you know, one other since we suspect him of a couple of others, but you know, the matter of Kathleen Downs has been before the coroner's court, and that was Mick Daly took that investigation on,
And that was Kathleen Downs was 90 in a nursing home,
or I think in a nursing home on New Year's Eve, and stabbed to death. And Mick Daly, in his tenacious way, pursued that to the coroner's court. Well, where I think just before he retired, the coroner Ian Gray basically nominated, and in his finding, that Du Pastel's a murderer. And the status is at the moment, I'm not exactly sure what's going on with it. It may be before the APP. So, but yeah, so third conviction for Du Pastel for murder, and that was for Messina. Life, no minimum, triple life he's doing. Whitey will keep going. Victims' families again, justice for them. So as a result of the first trial in Messina held Vargas, the defence appealed. And he appealed all the way to pass on all the other murders. So we had to jump every hoop on every particular conviction and sentence. And it was an appeal. And then for the first two murders, the appeals were knocked out, Mar and Patterson and Nicky. So he then appealed against the second, appealed against Messina's conviction, and we ended up at the High Court of Australia.
So much work, incredible amount of work involved.
Absolutely. For you,
like
huge
and huge pressure.
Huge. And then we ended up flying myself and Scarlett in the OPP, ended up flying up the High Court where it was fought, you know, an appeal was fought at the High Court. And as a result of that appeal, it came back for a retrial. And we came back and ran the trial again, and got all the witnesses again and gave evidence, and Fraser gave evidence again. And as a result of that, the jury went out again and convicted him, and he received life, no minimum, again. And then he appealed again.
How much money? Do you have any idea how much money this costs?
I understand that. Millions of dollars.
Yeah.
But I'm not exactly sure. It's, you know, we don't do the amounts of money you can see by these other cold case shows and that, you know, they're getting results. And, you know, you never give up.
No, but it's just frustrating that someone like Peter Du Pastel, who was already convicted of two of these murders, can run through the cycle again and again and again and take the government to court and take you guys back and back.
Mm.
Yeah, it's interesting, but I won't go down.
No worries.
All right. Yeah.
What was it? What was the reason it went to retrial when you went to the High Court?
There was two separate grounds, and it's a while ago now. So, but on the separate grounds, one related to eyewitness identification and some technical issues at the trial.
Yeah.
And the other one was that he was so notorious that he'd never get a fair trial. And he ran the example of our mate with the toupee.
Tony Mockbell.
Tony Mockbell. I'm so notorious I'll never get a fair trial.
Yeah.
But that was knocked out. But it went back for a retrial. On the other ground.
In 1974, a prison psychiatrist noted that Du Pastel was he had a psychosexual problem, that he was using denial as a coping device, and that he was potentially dangerous and maybe impossible to treat. In your opinion, how many blokes like this are wandering the streets?
That doctor probably nailed it at that point in time.
That's it, and that was 74. So, I mean, obviously,
can I tell you that I've travelled extensively around the world?
Yeah.
And I've travelled with work extensively around the world. And we're in a really good position here in Australia.
Okay.
It's different to a lot of other societies. You know, the bigger, larger populations and that, where you've got some strange cats. But look, there are those people wandering around, but at the end of the day, Our murder rate is between 60 and 80 a year compared to some other, areas in the world, countries in the world, which have a substantial, 10 times, 100 times, 1,000 times our murder rate. So,
and for a serial killer?
Yeah.
It's very rare again.
And that, we have not a lot of serial killers in this country. You know, you can think about them probably on one or two hands, really, in the scheme of things. Snowtown.
Malat.
We did an interview with the family of Nanette Ellis, whose 1984 murder has never been solved, and I know that the crew reinvestigating that definitely looked at Dupas because of the nature of her murder. He was ruled out, but she was stabbed to death, someone entered the home, not forcibly. Yeah, so they definitely.
I remember doing a review myself on that particular homicide many years ago there, and it then went further on the cold case for them to have a look later on. But yeah, we ruled him out. We ruled him out of a lot of other murders because he was either in custody.
Yeah.
He has been in custody a lot, hasn't he, throughout his
decades.
Life?
Decades.
Yeah.
So I guess
decades.
That makes
so it. He's ruled out and he's alibied and he's out. So. Yeah.
Do you believe he's done more than Kathleen Downs? And
yeah, how many do you think he's really?
Well, there's Renita Brunton, in Sunbury, in a second-hand clothing store.
Mm-hmm. Helen McMahon
at the Ryback Beach in 1984. Mm-hmm. My understanding is he did a rape a month after the murder in a locality very close to where Helen was murdered. And we also believe that he was on day release the day of Helen McMahon's murder. So,
wow.
But, they're jobs for the homicide squad and the cold case squad to look at and so on. And, they'll never give up.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. And thank you for your continued support of the podcast. We'll be back next Thursday with another installment.